You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
5 minutes after 10. Thank you so much for staying with us on the Eusebius McKayser Show. We start off this hour in the first 30 minutes of it by having a look at that fascinating judgment that was handed down last week by the Supreme Court of Appeal. And I have it in front of me. And I've been trying to work through it and think critically about it. This, of course, is in the matter between Jacob Zuma and the DA, the Acting National Director of Public Prosecutions and the head of the Directorate of Special Operations. And it was a fascinating one. You will remember that while argument was going on in court in real time, we had Associate Professor of Law at WITS and Criminal Law Advocate James Grant on the show, and him and I were busy doing our nerdish dance on radio, which we love doing. And I think our prediction was, while he schooled us on a very important finer point of law, that it's not so much in terms of case law that the motive is irrelevant behind the prosecuting team work, but that on its own, it is not sufficient to be decisive in saying that can be a rational basis to drop an otherwise winnable case, particularly when a fair trial can be guaranteed for the accused. And while we were doing that, there was that spectacular concession that happened in court at the same time from the Zuma team. And I haven't spoken, at least not on radio, to Professor Grant since then. So we thought we'll check in and hopefully inform you, and I'm sure we will, of how to make sense of what played out in the interim. I think he's in Botswana. Prof Grant, good morning.
Good morning, yes indeed. I'm in Gaborone at the moment.
Look at you, international man of mystery.
Managed to get away for a little bit, but only to do more work here.
Thank you for taking time out. Your generosity for the show, really, sometimes I feel like I'm abusing our friendship. But thank you, because we love the public education you do around law. I want to start with one point first, before we get on to the substance of the issue. Remember when you and I were talking about the case on air while it was playing out in court? Obviously, we didn't see that concession coming. Did you secretly see it coming, but you didn't say so on my show?
No, not at all. I thought that they would continue to play the game, at least.
So what do you think, from a legal strategy point of view, why do you think they would have made such a spectacular concession?
I really don't know, because by making the concession, they've attracted a cost order. But had they not, the court would have found, no doubt, as they that they were there on spurious grounds and made a cost order against them in any event. I don't understand. In fact, the question really to be asked, I suppose, is what were they doing there in the first place?
Yeah.
And the answer to that, of course, is that I don't understand, and I'm yet to meet anybody who does.
Well, let's get into the judgment, which is absolutely fascinating, because the court does several things in it that if you are a student of law, you would really be just incredibly excited by jurisprudentially. It raises, besides T.S. Eliot, it raises very interesting questions, almost thinking aloud at the beginning, Professor Grant, about why it is that the other side would even have made the concession, and wondering aloud whether in part it couldn't be because possibly there are some pretty important reasons for confirming the fact that setting aside the charges against Zuma are irrational. And in a sense, if you don't have those formally, officially ventilated, then maybe the court will not pronounce on them. But the court goes on, and it's quite wide in scope. And let's start with the first specific issue in that regard. It was very clear that in a chronology of the events that had led up to the moment of the judgment being handed down, that even if there was some sort of conversation between wicked folks about the timing of when to bring charges against JZ, the court seemed to make a lot out of the fact that the prosecuting team that was assigned to this particular case was not party to that discussion.
Yes. And that follows, I suppose, from the fact that the provision under which the then acting deputy director made the decision requires that he consult, and indeed he did say that he did consult, whereas you have now not only clear evidence to the contrary, we have also evidence showing that on various occasions, affidavits that have been sworn to, where people have been saying this is the truth, I, for instance, either did consult or I didn't consult, have been shown, by virtue of what was put before the SCA in this case, to be false, and people have been lying.
And what is interesting there for me is, I don't know the first thing about criminal law, but it seemed as if the court is implying or explicitly saying so, that just because your title is National Director or Acting National Director, it does not mean that you can somehow take a decision on your own when the people who have been doing the day-to-day running of the prosecution were Mr. William Downer, SC, Anton Steinberg, Deputy Director of Public Prosecution from KZN, Mr. George Baloy from Gauteng, Mr. Johan Duploy, the Senior Special Investigator with the DSO. And I thought that was quite interesting because beyond our interest in Jacob Zuma, it also tells us something about the court's view of how a director should go about consulting with his team that had been assigned to the case all along.
Right. I think what we're seeing is the statutory requirement that he should consult, but there's also clearly an admin law requirement coming through here where you're seeing the court's views that to take a proper decision, you have to consult properly with all relevant parties, and that follows from admin law, and it's what in admin law you call one of the principles of natural justice. Decide something properly, you have to hear from everybody.
One of the interesting things which I had forgotten about with my old age is that the language used by the acting director himself in explaining this decision to set aside the charges, there was actually plenty of material there that the court used as another basis for underscoring the overall judgment, James. And I wonder if we can speak to that. And what I mean precisely is that the court was at pains to point out that the acting national director, by his own assessment, had not opposed the prosecuting team assigned to the case, their judgment that there is a case to be answered, that the right to a fair trial will be guaranteed, and that there is a watertight buffet of evidence of prima facie wrongdoing. And I thought that was important because it was part of the basis why the court presumably is so keen to say that a wicked prosecutorial motive on its own in this instance is not the textbook example of when it is contra justice to proceed with a case.
You're absolutely spot on. And there's another thing going on that I found very interesting, which is that the court was saying that, but they also pointed out that on in addition to all of that, we're also only getting that story through the veil of another person's interpretation, and that's Willy Hofmeyr.
Yes.
We don't see the story that you need as the NPA and as Zuma's legal representative to sketch. You don't see that evidence being put before us by the person who was ultimately responsible, which is Sheikh. We have Willy Hofmeyr giving his account of what Mshere thought and did, and Mshere only confirming it all in one or possibly two confirmatory affidavits, which they didn't seem to think, and I think rightly so, was adequate at all.
One thing that confused me, and I was going to get to this after the break, but let's stay with it now and then we'll take a bit of a breathe and then we'll have a couple more minutes left, was how Willy Hofmeyr appears in this. Now, let's just step back from the minutiae and keep it simple, James. I mean, you know, in most of the public's imagination, Willy Hofmeyr, good guy. And then he gets scolded in this judgment, partly for obfuscating who took that decision about the timing, whether it was Leonard McCarthy or Mokotedi himself. And Willy comes out not quite unambiguously a good guy in this judgment.
Absolutely. This is the first time that I've ever seen his credibility, integrity called into question. is a release possibly of Mokotedium shares. Integrity, although the court wasn't very kind to Mshe, this is the first time that the court drew some serious negative attention to the role of Willie Hofmeyr in this court.
Absolutely. Let's take a break there. 16 minutes after 10. Are there aspects of the judgment you want to put to Professor James Grant? You can SMS a quick question, 31702 31567, or give us a call and you can put the question directly to him or tweet us a question for him. He's so lucid. I'm sure you are understanding every single word. The line is not ideal, but we'll see how long it will last. We have him for another 10 minutes or so. So we'll take a bit of a break. And then the next question I will put to Professor James Grant is, what is the operating effect of this judgment? We've asked that question every single time when this matter has been before the court. And every single time there's a new opportunity for the court to give clarity on the operating effect. In other words, the practical meaning of the judgment from the rising of the court. You still find lawyers disagreeing about how to interpret it. So let's take a break and hear what his take is on that question on the other side of this.
Eusebius is on Twitter at Eusebius.
20 minutes after 10, and we're in conversation with Professor James Grant, Associate Professor of Law at WITS and Criminal Law Advocate. James, what is the operating effect of this particular judgment?
I believe that this reverses time to the point in time just before Mokotedium Shea the decision to withdraw the prosecution. The effect of that is, we sit here now, I presume you're sitting, there is a pending prosecution against Jacob Zuma.
So when Jacob Zuma's team says, please, pretty please, with a cherry on top, do not put it on the court roll, give us a chance to make submission again, when they do that, are they entitled to be heard, or is the opportunity to be granted to them itself subject to what the NPA decides whether it wants to hear submission from them?
So I think there's two things going on there. The first is, just to be clear on what the actual effect of the judgment is in terms of what's going on right now. And that is, to be very clear, and if anybody's in any doubt about this, because there was some doubt about this after the Pretoria High Court, the Gauteng North High Court handed down judgment. And people have been saying, but why haven't the Supreme Court of Appeals clarified it? It did, people. If anybody wants clarity and they're still missing it, go to paragraph 61 of the Supreme Court of Appeals judgment, where it says that the ineluctable consequence of striking down the decision is five. The decision to prosecute. You don't get clearer than that. But just in case there was some confusion on that, there is now a pending decision to prosecute. The only thing that remains outstanding is an indictment and summons all the various parties to court. So what would happen now is that if representations were going to be made, those representations would be directed at causing the NPA to withdraw the prosecution, as opposed to causing the NPA to decide not to prosecute.
Okay. Okay. Absolutely clear. Absolutely clear. 22 minutes after 10.
Eusebius McKaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
I wonder what, and obviously this is speculative, but I wonder what they could possibly still have left by way of making submission to get the NPA to withdraw the matter, Professor Grant, because the one thing that we do not have clarity on in the judgment is precisely what the content is, I think, of the shopping list of people whose names are listed as the prosecuting team, including Downer. When they describe the case as watertight, they must know what evidence they obviously have. So for the Zuma legal team to be confident that they have enough in their back pocket to again have a, hopefully this time for their sake, a lawful basis for having the matter withdrawn, they would have had to have a equivalent of a little judicial peek into what it is that the state has.
Well, they would have been furnished with the docket. They're entitled to that. So they would know what the case is against them. Regrettably, what we can't say is that we can expect that whatever move that they make is justified by some sort of valid basis. Unfortunately, we have to rely on the experience that we've had, where we've now seen that sometimes they get before a court, most recently before the Supreme Court of Appeal, without anything to say. And could it be the case that they might want to make representations here simply in order to postpone matters? It's entirely possible. I'm not saying it's necessarily the case. Is there anything that we know of? Well, certainly they themselves, from what I can gather, are speaking or making references to the KPMG report.
Yes, I saw that.
Yes. Now, is that the sort of thing that you now, as an accused person, get to raise and throw at the NPA's office and say, you see, now you don't get to prosecute me, I'm sorry. If that was any of my clients and I wrote to the NPA drawing their attention to this, I would very much expect a letter back saying, well, good luck to you. That's fantastic news for you. We'll see you at trial.
Absolutely. It gives new meaning to the kitchen sink approach. It's more like throwing the entire Nkandla homestead and hoping something will stick. Let's take one or two calls. Quick one, Nina. Good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Hi. You see this, I will just rush through it. 2 points. Number one, the point that was made by Stephen Friedman is that the NPA, i.e. Sean, would not necessarily work particularly hard to press charges to, you know, work through the issues involved. And so that would be the next problem in the entire process. The second point is that in terms of the issue of representations, his point was that because we are now 10 years later, other evidence could have emerged or other factors could have emerged. So this is a way in which one could sort of prolong the whole process and re-establish what was important. Thank you, Cedia.
Thanks, Nina. Let's take Nina's first question in the interest of time. We'll dispense with the second. The first crossed my mind, but I thought, and I don't know if I was reading too much into the judgment here, James, that there's a reason why the court underscored the fact that it was irrational. It wasn't just Obita Dykter comments. They declared it irrational of Mokotedi to not have spoken to the prosecuting team, including Downer and his buddies. And I would imagine that the legal import of that is that Sean the Sheep could not take a decision that does not engage the views of their team.
You know, we're left in the most peculiar of circumstances because when you look at what the SCA itself back in 2009 in the Harms judgment and now endorsed in this recent SCA judgment has said is the route which the president needs to take is instead of relying on the authority of the national director to review a decision to prosecute, the accused here, the president, must rely on another provision, which really is an empowering provision. It's section 1972, and it simply sets out that the national prosecuting authority is authorized and empowered to prosecute, and it must be given all such necessary powers and resources to prosecute. Now, the 2009 SCA judgment took that to mean that the NPA officials also have the authority not only to institute prosecutions, but also to stop them. Now, at that point in time, I'm struggling to see it. And I'm also very troubled by how it is that the accused at this point, and even if I'm coming to the defense of the president, I have to say this, I'm struggling to understand how the representatives of the president are now supposed to write to NPA, and it would necessarily mean subordinates of the director, because he has to be left out of account, to review a decision of their head. I'm not entirely sure how this is going to operate.
Absolutely. We'll squeeze in two quick ones. If they're not capable of being answered quickly, we'll do them in a future discussion. But just from the cheap seats on Twitter, Frank wants to know, please ask Professor Grant, Michael Hulley illegally obtained spy tapes yet was never prosecuted. Well, there isn't much clarity on that and the origins, right? It's sort of like left hanging, that issue.
That's absolutely correct. And I haven't heard of any legal basis on which he was in possession of them. And I think these questions are being rightly asked.
Yes. And then a final one that's rightly being asked, a wonderful, awkward one for you, for reasons you and I know. Someone else says, please ask the professor. Mche admitted in an affidavit that he basically lied to the prosecuting team. Doesn't that mean that he's fit and improper to ever be either an acting or an actual judge henceforth?
It's going to be very... he's going to have to do some explaining. And I, let me put it on the record. I work with him. I've learned to struggle with how it is that he is in my dealings with him and the decision that he made this night,
yes,
that has been called into question. The two just I cannot reconcile in my mind. But let me say, trying to be as objective as I can, yes, his integrity has been called into question. He will need to do some explaining.
Thanks, James. Love your brain. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Cheers. That was Professor James Grant. And there's a man with integrity that cannot be doubted, eh? Awkward having to answer questions about people you work with. Associate Professor of Law at Wits and criminal law advocate and expert.